OK, so my name is Kevin Schlafman, and I'm going to tell you how to find apparently bright, intrinsically luminous metal poor stars everywhere in the galaxy. So this project is an equal collaboration with Andy Casey, who is a postdoc at the Institute of Astronomy in Cambridge. And I am here delivering this talk because I'm in charge of North American marketing. So if you wanted to find metal poor stars in the halo or anywhere, these are your choices until very recently. So you could have gone to the Hombre. So this is a histogram with V magnitude on the x-axis and then counts in these catalogs on a log scale on the y-axis. You had a few choices. You could go to the Hombre ESO survey, which is this light blue histogram. You could go to the SDSS DR12, which is this green. Or you could go to Anna Frabel's compilation from her 2006 paper. And what you can see here is I've also indicated about how much time it takes to get a decent high-resolution, high-signal-to-noise spectrum on a 6 to 10-meter class telescope. It takes about 10 minutes for a V of 13 star and about 5 hours for, say, a V of 17 star. And so the bright stars in these catalogs have been completely picked over. And so if you wanted to get the nth plus one metal poor star, you would have been forced to go to these very faint candidates. And very faint candidates are very telescope time intensive to study in more detail. And so if you want to make progress, you have to find a way to find more bright metal poor stars. And one way to use this, or one way to do this, is to use WISE data. So here I've plotted on the x-axis wavelength in microns, and on the y-axis flux density plus an offset. These are two theoretical models for the atmospheres of K-giant stars. This is an FENH of minus 1 star. This is an FENH of minus 3 star. And I've also plotted the WISE-1 and WISE-2 bands. And so what you can see is that there's an enormous amount of absorption due to molecules, mostly carbon monoxide, in the WISE-2 band for this FENH of minus 1 star that largely disappears for an FENH of minus 3 star. And so WISE colors alone, W1 minus W2, gives you leverage on what stars are metal poor, so long as you can tell that the star is cool using some other data. We have two-mass data over the entire sky, and you can use those two-mass data to pick out cool stars, then use the WISE W1 and W2 colors to pick out the metal poor stars. And so a pilot survey using this technique has shown that 32.5% of our candidates are between minus 3 and minus 2, and 4% of our candidates are between minus 4 and minus 3. So this is comparable to what was done using the objective prism technique with the Hombre ESO survey, but we have these data over the entire sky. Because the data is over the entire sky, there's a lot of volume at bright apparent magnitudes, and so we find bright candidates. And now if I show the same plot I showed before, now our data is plotted in this darker blue histogram, we have a very large number of candidates at bright apparent magnitudes. So we have, in fact, 12,000 candidates brighter than V of 14. So that's a five-fold increase over what was available before, all based on public data and all publicly available to the community. So not only are our stars apparently bright, they're also intrinsically bright. And so if I assume that the stars, our candidates which we haven't observed, are comparable to the stars we have already observed in our pilot survey, then this is what the approximate galactocentric distance distribution of our candidates would be. This again is on a log scale on the y-axis. And so we have tens of thousands of candidates between, say, 30 and 50 galactocentric kiloparsecs. And so I've indicated these candidates are found in the more distant halo, much more distant than typical extremely metal poor star catalogs. We've initiated an all-sky follow-up program using this technique, both in the north with Gemini North GMOS to pre-screen candidates, and then follow up with APF LIVI from Lick Observatory. And in the south, we're doing the same thing, pre-screening with Gemini South, and then observing the candidates which come through with Magellan Mike. So not only can this technique find metal poor stars in the halo, it can also find metal poor stars in highly extinct and reddened regions, in fact, in particular in the bulge. So we found the most metal poor stars, which are now known in the bulge. When our paper came out this fall, these were the three most metal poor stars known. Now there's kind of a tie with this one, but we still have the two most metal poor stars known in the bulge. And metal poor stars in the bulge are interesting because halos form from the inside out. And so at constant metallicity, the most ancient stars are those that are the most tightly bound to the galaxy. And in fact, Jason Tumlinson studied this question in detail in a theoretical model. And if you take his results at face value, there's a 70% chance that at least one of our three stars formed above redshift 10. So these stars are intrinsically bright. We already have high resolution, high signal to noise spectra. And so we've looked at their detailed chemical abundances. And for most elements, they're exactly the same as the metal poor stars which are seen in the halo at constant metallicity, with one important exception. And that exception is scandium. So these stars have the lowest scandium measurements which have been seen in extremely metal-poor stars in the halo. Scandium is an interesting element because there's some tension between what's predicted from garden variety supernova yields and what's observed in the metal-poor stars in the halo. And in fact, our stars go in the direction which the garden variety supernova models suggest that the abundances should go. So the result is the progenitors of the Milky Way at redshift 10 have an abundance pattern which is very similar to what's seen in the halo metal-poor stars, with the possible exception of scandium. So whatever enrichment process goes on at high redshift, it produces an abundance pattern very similar to what's already been seen in extremely metal-poor stars in the halo. So this technique, I think, has some more possibilities as we ramp up the survey. So the first thing is it can provide metal-poor K-giants as tracers of the distant halo. And so these can then be followed up with radial velocities and low-resolution spectroscopy in a number of upcoming wide-field spectroscopic surveys. Related to what we've talked about so far today, these also can provide candidates for asteroseismological observations of extremely metal-poor stars. So they're quite bright, which is useful. They're very far up the red giant branch, so their oscillations are long. So you don't need very short cadence data, although you do need a longer baseline. This technique can also be used to find extremely metal-poor stars in dwarf galaxies, including the Magellanic Clouds. All you need is existing archival Spitzer photometry, because the Spitzer IRAC channel 1 and channel 2 bands are very similar to the WISE W1 and W2 bands. So Spitzer data can allow you to apply this technique. As I indicated, it also works very well in highly reddened regions like the bulge. This is something which Martin Asplund, if he had been here, would have talked about at some length, because they have an upcoming sample which is actually quite a bit bigger than the three stars Andy Casey and I found. You can also apply this technique to find extremely metal-poor stars in the halos of nearby galaxies, which we'll be able to observe with JWST and NIRCam in its GRISM spectroscopy mode. Finally, the brightest stars which we're in our sample are going to be the excellent candidates to observe in the UV with HST to measure the abundances of rare elements, which have the real power to discriminate between different models of supernova yields. And then finally, once Gaia produces parallaxes and proper motions for these stars, we'll be able to do a very detailed orbital analysis of the metal-poor stars in our catalog relative to garden variety halo stars to see if there's any signal of differences about how these stars came to be. And that's all I have to say. I'll take questions.
Thanks. Staying very well in time. Victor.
Thanks. This is actually really interesting. Two very simple questions. Have you been in contact with Dennis or somebody to make sure that your good candidates are in the observing list of K2?
Yeah, so this is something which I checked the first few. This technique didn't exist, or rather we didn't have proof that this technique worked until, say, August. Okay. And so then I checked the upcoming deadlines for proposals for, I think, the Campaign 3 and Campaign 4, and we had candidates which were close, but not actually in the fields on silicon. And so I haven't circled back to that yet to see what
end of February now we have to submit for the next campaigns. And have you checked the Kepler field?
And so this is something which Josh Simon suggests that I do when I talked to him about this a couple of months ago, but again, I haven't had time to check that yet.
Lars?
I'm trying to understand, you showed a plot which implied that these could be very far away, which I guess I don't understand. So these are old stars, so the brightest, what kind of stars do you think they are?
These are K-giants near the tip of the red giant branch.
Fine, so that's then minus 5.
Well, minus 2-ish, yeah.
Well, it depends on what color you like to live in. So I don't see how you're going to get anything at 200 kiloparsecs.
So again, some of our stars have a surface gravity of like 0.5. So if I assume that some fraction of our stars have a surface gravity of 0.5, then they do have that luminosity. And then there is a tail of candidates to faint apparent magnitudes. And if you do have a very low surface gravity, very luminous star at the faint apparent magnitude, say a V of 15, then it is potentially at this distance.
So I have a question. What is the main source of contamination in your samples? Because you had said like 32% or something.
Yeah,
like that.
So it depends on the apparent magnitude range. So at the apparent magnitudes that we've explored the most right now, the main contaminant is stars which have an infrared excess. So young stars, in fact. So most of our contaminants have emission in the cores of the calcium H and K, which are indicative of a young star which has dust. And that's why it appears to be bright in W2, not because it's metal poor, but because it is an infrared access source. And in fact, the idea that the paper which led me to conceive this project was a paper looking for infrared access in the Kepler field. And so it makes sense that the main contaminant would be infrared access sources.
In the back? Question? Oh, yeah.
Just real quick, how do you know those extremely metal poor stars are in the bulge and not halo interlopers?
So they're very bright. So the SPM4 and UCAC4 proper motions are available for them. So we were able to take our distance estimates, the proper motions, and do an orbital analysis. And two of those three stars have orbits which don't take them out of the bulge. One of the stars could be a halo interloper, but it would be on such an extreme orbit that I think it's more likely that there's some error with the proper motions, because the UCAC4 and SPM4 proper motions have the same first epoch. And so if there's a problem with one plate, both proper motion catalogs could be wrong. So in fact, if the proper motion is 20 milli arc seconds per year for that star, which would have a very extreme halo orbit if in fact proper motion was accurate.
Yeah, in the back.
Kevin, can you select carbon-rich metal poor stars?
So that's an excellent question. So it seems like we would be biased against carbon.
Yes.
So if there was a star that had Fe on H of -2 and carbon to iron of +2, that star would not make its way into our catalog. But other than that, I think we don't have much leverage on carbon, both for that reason and also because these stars are very far up the red giant branch, and so a lot of the carbon has been processed into nitrogen.
Yeah, that's right. And related to that, actually, what are your sort of least luminous stars? Because these cool giants, they have, I don't know if you've checked the Galax magnitudes, but my 12 magnitude Oort process star had a Galax magnitude of like 15, and so there's just nothing to see with HST.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
No,
so these stars are cool, but we have, just this past month, we got about 100 candidates from the APF LEVI, which had V magnitudes between about 8.5 and 9.5. We haven't analyzed those data yet, but our expectation is that at least several of those will be, say, between -2.7 and -3. So if those pan out, then those will be bright enough for HST. Oh, that's an excellent point. Thank you.
Any other questions or remarks?
Yeah. Welcome to New York. Just out of curiosity, so a couple things, and I'm sure we can talk later, but so did you develop a scaling relation? So I'm trying to understand this. Why is one W2 minus W1 scaling factor? Does it scale well with metallicity? Have you been able to assess that yet? Or?
So what we have right now is we have a technique which says this is either an interesting candidate or it's not. And it seems like the criteria is very effective at getting us to say Fe on H of -2. It doesn't seem like it has that much discriminatory power right now to get from Fe on H of -2 to Fe on H of -3. So it might be saturating at that point, but it is quite valuable to get these stars. And if you do look, I mean, the nice thing is that what we focused on so far are very bright. So in a limited amount of telescope time, you can accumulate a large sample. In fact, the three stars in the bulge only required 24 minutes of exposure time on Magellan to get objects which might be telling you about the redshift 10 universe. So it's still a very time-efficient way to do this kind of science.
No doubt. I'm actually really excited about this technique. But one other thing, did you cross-correlate against, for instance, the SSPP results? Because, I mean, this wouldn't be the first time that we missed something like that, unfortunately. But just to see, you know, how you scale against those and then just get some sort of sample, I guess.
Yeah, so the we've been focusing exclusively on the brightest stars, and those are not in the Sloan footprint. So I have done some cross-checking with Apogee, at least the not the DR12 Apogee release, the DR10 Apogee release. And those data were useful in helping pick some of these limits, but I haven't done it to try and figure out what the efficiency might be going to. But they were useful in helping outline the strategy.
Okay, let's thank Kevin again. Sarah Loebman is not here, so now we're going to switch to a poster session where all the poster authors get a short amount of time to present their poster, and they're all from Joe's laptop, so I'm handing the floor to him. And the last two talks, we'll take them up again at the discussion at the end of the day.